Working in the DV sector became the main driving force of my life, and you know, I worked way more hours than I ever got paid for, and never really switched off from it, I guess, for about 24 years.
Welcome to Her Story, an RTRFM podcast series exploring the remarkable lives of 12 inductees of the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. I'm Taylor Strano. I'll be with you each week as we hear stories from some of the trailblazing women who've left their mark on our world. This week, we meet a woman who spent her adult life advocating for social justice. Keddie Crystal has worked in the area of family and domestic violence for more than 30 years. Keddie is a Justice of the Peace working voluntarily in the Magistrates Court, hearing family violence restraining orders, and is also an independent prison visitor to Boronia Pre-Release Centre. Keddie Crystal was an inaugural inductee to the WA Women's Hall of Fame in 2011. This is her story. And just a heads up, there are issues of violence and assault discussed in this episode. Enter with care.
Keddie Crystal, Training Coordinator for Grey. Okay, so I was born in New Zealand. I had a reasonably happy childhood, fairly conservative childhood. I think it was a fairly sheltered childhood until I got to probably about 17. And then a few things happened, and then I left New Zealand at 18 and came to Sydney as a very young, naive 18-year-old and lived in Sydney, and then started to probably, I guess, run amok and have my eyes open to a wider perspective of the world.
Obviously, you've been involved in volunteer space and in advocacy space for such a long time. There's a lot of patience and a lot of compassion that comes into that. Do you know where that comes from or when that was ignited for you?
I guess for me, probably feminism was one of the huge driving forces. So I married very young, and by the time I was 22, I had 3 children. And I've always read a lot. And so I was here in Perth as a 22-year-old. Married, reading a lot about feminism, starting to view the world in a different way, understanding patriarchy, living in a marriage that was with a violent partner, and I guess that then became an impetus for me to then become involved in the domestic violence sector, which then drove the desire to make things better for women and children, and from that the rest of the sort of advocacy and volunteering that I've done over the years has been driven mostly by seeing injustice and feeling like I wanted to make a difference and change that.
So you have you're coming, I guess, from a place of lived experience then in what has essentially been your entire career since your early 20s.
Predominantly, yes. I started at Nadim Women's Refuge in 1983, which is one of the oldest domestic violence services in WA, and I worked there for 4 years. I helped start Young Single Women's Refuge, and then I took some time out. At that point I probably was a little bit burnt out by the work and being a single mum and having young children, and also coming out as a lesbian and working as an activist in that field at that time as well. So I took some time out for a few years, went over east, spent some time on the women's land, came back to Perth in 1991, and then started working for a little while in the youth sector. So I worked in Kundoola and Girraween Youth Service, which really opened my eyes to the plight of young Indigenous women who were street present or about to be street present. But found that work really difficult. Found it incredibly difficult to work with young people who were at such high risk but perceived themselves as invincible to all the dangers that they were facing. And at that time also the HIV/AIDS epidemic had struck as well. So I went back to working in refuges in 1992.
So when it rains, it pours. I think you, Keddie, you're the kind of person I imagine that's in for a penny, in for a pound, right?
Yes. Working in the DV sector became the main driving force of my life. And, you know, I worked way more hours than I ever got paid for and never really switched off from it, I guess, for about 24 years.
I want to talk a little bit more about the work that you've been doing for the last few decades in a moment, but can you take me back to your early 20s? You're in Perth. I can't imagine you had many people around here. When you were reading about feminism, what was sort of the coin drop moment for you? What was the part of that was like, ha, this is what we need to be doing more of now?
Well, I had no family or friends around me because of the violent marriage I was in. But one of the things I had done before I got involved in this refuge sector is that I went to Claremont Teachers College and trained for 3 years to be a primary school teacher. And that was through part of my marriage and the ending of my marriage. And that opened me up to, I remember particularly one woman I met there and became friends with, and I hadn't had any friendships for probably, I don't know, 10 years maybe, through most of the marriage. And she was also a survivor of domestic and family violence, and she talked to me about going to a refuge, her experience of going to a refuge. And at that time, I very clearly remember deciding for myself I wanted to be out of my marriage, but there was no way I was going to take my children to a refuge because of the stigma and the constraints and my perception of what it might mean to go to a refuge. That opened up my eyes to how difficult it was to get out of that domestic violence situation. And then, you know, reading Erin Pizzi's book, Scream Silently, All the Neighbours Will Hear, reading Germaine Greer, reading all of that, and then I guess moving into being part of the gay and lesbian scene at that time, it just sort of pushed me into this whole understanding that having a white middle class background, that wasn't the only way to view the world.
Mm. Can you speak to the significance of having those women only spaces in those times and now as well?
Absolutely. I mean, and when I started working in Nadim Women's Refuge, we were a collective, which is not a structure that refuges operate under anymore, unfortunately. So that was an experience just in itself, being part of a collective where you worked on the theory that everybody's role was equal, that everybody could do all the jobs that were there. You all got paid the same amount, which was a pittance, but you still got paid. And one of the standard things there was that we would never employ any social workers because we saw them as coming from a certain perspective and a certain belief system around the other. And I think that for me has been a really strong issue for me around working in women's refuges, that being a victim of domestic and family violence can happen to anybody. It is not something that happens to just those women over there for certain reasons. And I've really struggled with that attitude that sometimes comes through, that it's, we're here to help the poor women, that, you know, and for me, we were all that we were there to do was to walk alongside them in their journey and advocate for what they identified they needed, not what we thought they needed. And that's always been a tension in my work.
So the perception of a women's refuge, some might view it as like a rehabilitation service, but you're saying it's not that, it's quite purely about advocacy.
It's about advocating for the women, but it's also about recognising that there is no difference between them and us. We aren't trying to reduce that power, that imbalance that often does occur. And to say that domestic violence can happen to anybody. There's no safeguards against it. There's nothing. You can be living in Dalkeith and your husband can be earning hundreds of thousands of dollars, but he still might be not necessarily physically hurting you, but he might control and have power and make all the decisions in your life. And that's a very difficult place to be, as much as it is to be living in a very low socioeconomic area with no resources. It's just as hard.
Do you feel like there's been significant change in the domestic and family violence sector? Have you been able to see that happen?
There has been change, absolutely. There's been change in the way police view it and the way police are trained in it. There's been some change in the way courts address it. And there's been some change now that there's much more variety of services and we have a much better nuanced understanding of what domestic violence is and the impact that it has on women and children. Absolutely, we've come a long way, but in that, it's also become much more complex because we now understand much more about the impact on the brain and we understand much more about the impact on children. and the provision of services hasn't kept up as our understanding has grown.
Can you speak about the relationship, Keddie, between those changes and what is currently the lay of the land and sort of your role as a policy officer? I know that you were a policy officer for the Women's Council for Domestic and Family Violence Services. Can you explain to us a little bit about what that actually looks like?
Well, in terms of changes, you know, one of the things that I was really pleased to be part of when I was working for the Women's Council was the new piece of legislation around non-fatal strangulation. Non-fatal strangulation as a standalone offence only came into law in 2019 in this state. What we came to understand from a piece of research that SARC did is that men were using strangulation to control their partners, primarily often when they were sexually assaulting them, but for a whole range of other reasons. And we had worked, I had worked in the DV sector for, you know, over 30 years at that stage. We had never asked women about this experience. So while I was at the Women's Council, we did a 12-month survey where we got refuges across the state to ask women coming into refuge, has your partner ever done this? Has he ever put something around your throat and impeded your breathing in some way? Whether that was grabbing your T-shirt or whether that was using his hands. We had over 500 women say yes. And the whole sector was completely floored by having this thing that was going on for women that we weren't, wasn't on our radar at all. We weren't asking questions about it. The women didn't understand how dangerous it was. They didn't understand the risk of acquired brain injury. So this information was like seeping out across various states. We're starting to put legislation in. Working with SARC, we brought over some trainers from America who did a two-day workshop here, completely blew everybody away because they were further down the track on their understanding around this. Coming out of that, we got this legislation now. We've got police now that are being trained, and we've got, after the legislation came in, over 90 charges were laid immediately by police against men. So this has been happening to women for years. It hadn't come across our radar, and when we did come across it, in my opinion, one of the failings was that the education that needed to go out to this community has not kept up to scratch in terms of, we've got legislation, police understand it better, hospitals understand it better, but we still don't have it out to the women who are actually still out there experiencing it.
Mm. That's a monumental piece of legislation to come through.
It was amazing.
What was the feeling or sort of the general vibe around, like, when you got the call that that was going to become law?
We were very excited about it and very pleased that the state government had picked up on it reasonably quickly. The legislation is very good because it looked at what had happened in Queensland and in New Zealand, and it basically tweaked the legislation here so that we didn't repeat some of the problems that had come out of legislation that particularly Queensland had done. So it is very positive, but what they failed to do substantially here, in my opinion, was back it up with a good community education campaign. There was a small campaign, but it wasn't as hard-hitting and as strong and as widespread as we really needed it to be. So there's still some work to be done in that area.
It's like one of those always developing, always needing to be worked on sort of spaces.
Yeah. And so much of the DV sector is, you know, there's been our understanding of the impact of abuse in the family home on animals, that includes animals, and the impact that that has on women and children making decisions not to leave because they don't want to leave their pets behind. When I was at Pat Giles, we started a program called Safe Families, Safe Pets, which was a fostering pets program, which we ran out of our refuge for women coming into our refuge so that they could come with their pet and then we'd find a foster home, mostly for dogs because dogs are the hardest ones to place. At the refuge, we allowed women to come in if the pet could be caged. So we had cats and rabbits and guinea pigs and things like that coming in.
A menagerie.
A menagerie at times. But dogs were always difficult. So we had a fostering dog program. So then when this state government came to power, there was some lobbying work done and they then funded the RSPCA to provide refuges with support to foster animals so that women could leave. So that understanding that men would use the inflict damage and injury on pets as a way of controlling their partner and their children is only a fairly recent thing.
Such a complex, so many moving parts sort of system and things that I think people who have never come face to face with that sort of violent home life or sexually violent home life have ever really had to consider. So the fact that these refuges and the work that you've done at Patricia Giles Centre is something that even existed, even if it was in more recent times, is pretty outstanding and pretty remarkable.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I feel very proud of the time that I was at the Pat Giles Centre up to 2016, and the services that we started and the things that we did were, a lot of them were very innovative.
We talked about a few of the changes, some of the significant changes. One that we haven't mentioned is the change in language in the DV space. It's moved to focus on domestic and family violence now. Can you speak to us a little bit about what the importance of language in these kinds of sectors are?
The move to domestic and family violence is very much driven by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities because of that wider concept of family, and because the violence can be much more than just the intimate partner. So often for an Aboriginal woman, her partner may not be the violent person. It may be aunts or uncles or extended family members. And that's particularly also an issue around elder abuse, which has been another learning that's come out of the DV sector over time, the issue of elder abuse. And the other part of that in terms of language is that when we talk about GLBTI partner violence, the preferred language there is intimate partner violence rather than domestic violence. So it's very important to get language correct and to understand those nuances, because that is our learning around how complex this whole issue is. When I first started, refuges really believed and operated on a principle that all we had to do was get women and children out of the violent home safely into a refuge and then into their own home, and that would be the end of the work and they would be fine. Mm. And it's so much more complex than that.
It's wishful thinking these days, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about volunteer work. You mentioned before working countless hours and lots of them go off the, unfortunately, missed by the payroll is a polite way of saying that. What does volunteer work look like to you? What does that mean?
I guess for me, my volunteer work's mostly purely selfish in terms of what it gives me. When I was working at Pat Giles and working full-time, I didn't do anything for quite a long time. And then about 1999, what I was seeing is that our women were going to the local court at Joondalup and they were applying for restraining orders, and they were going before two justices of the peace to get a restraining order. And the comments and the questions that they were being asked were absolutely, in some cases, appalling, not in all cases, but really showed a complete lack of understanding by the JPs of domestic and family violence. So I, in my naivety at that time, thought, well, why don't I just become a JP and then I can influence and educate some of the JPs and we can improve this situation. So I applied to become a JP and went through the training at the TAFE and became a JP. And then our local court at Joondalup became a pilot project to become a domestic violence court, and the JPs stopped actually working in that court in terms of the restraining orders. And so in a work situation, we were still involved in that court. So then I left it for a little while, and then I went back to Murdoch and did a little bit of study and met some JPs there, and eventually became a JP sitting in at Perth Magistrates Court hearing restraining orders, which was a huge education for me. I'd been in the DV sector for a long time. I had a very fixed view around restraining orders, violence restraining orders in the DV context, but you know, there's other reasons why people need a restraining order apart from domestic and family violence. So I learned a lot out of that process. I got to know some JPs and got to work with them who had a reasonably good understanding of domestic and family violence, and I really enjoyed that work. And that went on for about 15 or so years up until last year when that all came to an end. And so coming out of that work, one of the JPs there talked to me about independent prison visitor, which is part of the Office of the Inspector of Custodial Services. And every prison and every remand centre in WA is visited once a month by an independent visitor. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, that sounds interesting, and I don't know very much about the prison system. though at that stage we had been involved. One of the things we did at Pat Giles is that we were running domestic violence groups at Bandyup Prison for the women, which was really another innovation and another thing that was absolutely of great benefit for those women. And so I became an independent prison visitor, and initially for the first probably 4 or 5 years I visited Bandyup Prison, which was a complete eye-opener for me. I just went in there not knowing anything and was completely appalled about the situation that many of those women found them in and the lack of services that the prison was able to offer them.
When you say the situation you found them in, what do you mean by that?
That Bandyup is a very old prison, so the conditions they were living under were in some cases quite appalling. They were sleeping on mattresses on the floor, they were doubled up. This is going back a few years, but they spent a lot of time with absolutely nothing to do. There was very little access to education. There was very little access to any other work options. What we know from the research is about 85 to 90% of women in prison have been victims of domestic and family violence. They've been victims of child sexual abuse. They've often not done very well in the education system, so the opportunities when they're incarcerated to actually improve their literacy and numeracy, it's an ideal opportunity. Those services weren't available. The health system in the prisons was always stretched to its limit, and often women would have health issues that weren't being treated well. So I was really appalled that in this day and age things were so bad. And from what I heard is that, in the women's prison system, they were at the bottom of the pile compared to the situation for men in men's prisons.
I didn't think that sexism was a thing that we needed to worry about in prison.
Absolutely we did. We do.
Right.
So I spent about 4 or 5 years visiting at Bandyup and got to meet some amazing women and got to know some amazing women in there. And I now visit at Boronia, which is like a swap to visiting like at the Hilton or something, because Boronia is not only physically and visually much more beautiful, it has much more capacity to support the women in a way that, they should be supported. And it's a reintegration prison. So while there's still some issues there, they are moving back out into society and they're in a different space, and the staff there are very supportive. So that's been a real learning.
I know and I understand the whole point of volunteer work is to, it's a very selfless act, but I cannot help but just think in the last 5 minutes you've just told me that you became a justice of the peace because people weren't quite doing it correct, so you've carved that space out for yourself, and from there you've been able now to become an independent prison visitor. That's a pretty steep learning curve, like you said, but also these are things that you just did because they weren't being done correctly.
Well, there was injustices there, and I think, a lot of the people that volunteer in this area, they do that because they see an injustice that they want to help or make things better for people, help out in some way. Because, it's the same with domestic violence, I haven't got any magical barrier that really stopped me being potentially a person that could have ended up in a prison system at some point, I don't know how to explain it, that we're really, anything can happen to you, and if it's going to go bad, you want it to at least have some people around you that are there being a voice for you or saying, this isn't okay, what can we do to change it?
Is it fair to say that you've, how would I put this, grasped the fragility of safety?
Yes,
is that a fair way to say it?
Yes, that would be one way to, yeah, and anything can go tits up very easily, basically.
And when it does, you want someone in your corner.
Absolutely, yeah.
Who understands the institution or the system.
Yeah, and it's not there telling you what you should be doing, but is there saying, okay, what has gone wrong? What do I know that might be of help? Who can I ask if I don't know that might be of help?
Talk to me a little bit about that. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but I know so-and-so or this person I can put you in touch with. What's sort of your circle of connection like? Do you have a lot of people in your life, Keddy, that you can call on if you need a favour or, you know, someone who's an expert in XYZ or you think this person would be able to help this particular inmate or whatever it might be?
At the time, yeah, probably not so much now because I'm, you know, not working full time, but certainly when I was in the DV sector, I probably had, you know, over time, because I was involved at the local level and at the state level and at the national level in the sector, had networks and people I could ring up and say, yeah, can you help or who should I talk to? This has happened.
You are able to provide support for a lot of people. Who supports you?
I have a small group of friends. I have a partner. I have my children. And I'm just a bit tough, I guess, underneath it all.
I think that you were tough from like the get-go, though. Yeah. Not something that's acquired by everybody as quickly, I think. On top of the work in the DV and family violence sector and the prison system, and being a justice of the peace at one stage as well, you've also worked in the people seeking asylum and refugee settlement space. Do you want to tell us a bit about what that's entailed?
Okay, I've done less of that, but I do feel really passionate. So currently I've been on the board of CARID for a few years. But one of the things that got me interested in this is when I was still at Pat Giles, we were starting to see a number of women coming into the refuge who were on temporary visas. So they weren't residents of Australia. They had no access to Centrelink. They had no access to Medicare. They had come to Australia and in some cases had been here, you know, a couple of years, either to marry an Australian man or had married an Australian man overseas and come in. They often had young children, and then violence had occurred. So they had often had no family here. They may have not had much English. And so we were seeing a significant number of these women coming through. They had nothing that financially had to be supported. And so one of the things I initiated there was a survey of refugees to try and see, was this happening right across the sector? So there's about 44 refuges in WA. And so from that, then I was asking refuges, you know, how many are you seeing and how are you supporting these women? How are you getting them food? How are you getting them paying their doctor's bills? How are you supporting the kids to go to school? How much is it costing the refuge? Because refuges are not funded to do any of that work. And so that those figures came back and they were quite substantial. And then I moved over to the Women's Council and I kept that survey running there. And we built up about 3 years worth of data saying on the numbers of women coming through and the cost to refuges of these women. And it was increasing all the time. And so then we were able to lobby the state government and get an initial grant of money so that what we had at the Women's Council was that individual refuges could apply on behalf of an individual woman. So the woman would go into the refuge, she'd be on a temporary visa, she'd have no access to anything. And then we would give her directly to the woman a small grant of money each week. And so that money was not to pay rent to the refuge or anything. That money was her own money that she could make her own decisions about. And that scheme is still running as far as I understand. And coming out of that, then there started to be some national advocacy work that I got involved in to try and lobby the visa categories and the link to Centrelink. Because these women, without being able to get some sort of grant from Centrelink and without being able to get access to Medicare, you can't survive. Like, you just can't survive. And the other group that people didn't seem to realise that was caught up in this process is women from New Zealand. So if you're a New Zealander and you come over here with your husband and things go wrong and you separate, you cannot get Centrelink or you cannot get Medicare for your kids. You have to work. Mm. And if you've got young kids, you may not have the capacity to get a job and manage, be a single mum and manage your kids and find a private rental. And so there was a number of New Zealand women that were caught up in this problem as well. So work is continuing. It's very, the national government is really resistant around issues of changing visas and recognising these women on temporary visas. But they're a growing cohort And over COVID, they actually funded some money through Red Cross to support this group. So there's a group that come into refuge, but there's also a larger group that are stay within their own communities that have no income, that are being basically supported by other members of the community because the Australian government will not support them financially.
That is a lot of information that you've just spoken to me off the top of your head. It's amazing. Something that I think I've learned about you in the last 30 minutes, Keddy, is that you just do things. If you see a problem, you just kind of go and
just
fix
have
it
a crack
or work on it.
Work on it, yeah. Have a crack at seeing if we can do something about it.
Has that always been the way that you've operated?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Do you think there's a reason for that, or is that just sort of how you remember being raised of if there's a thing, just fix it, or if you see an issue, work on it?
That's pretty much... Yeah, how it's been in terms of working on DV, because it's like, well, if I don't work on it, then often nobody else will pick it up, you know. But once a few people pick it up, then, you know, you can get some momentum going.
Makes light work of it, which I think is very much undercutting the entire conversation we've just been having. Is that how you define success then? If you can work on something and then other people can come and work on it with you?
Yeah, I guess I just have this, yeah, I don't know, it's just a strong work ethic. I find it really hard just to sit back and not do anything.
What does success look like to you then? Like, what would you look at maybe in your own career or in the world around you and go, that was a success, or like, I've done a successful thing?
I don't know. I don't see it as I've done a successful thing, but I've been part of things that have, you know, had an impact and made a difference. Yeah, absolutely.
We've talked a little bit about lived experience and that being part of the reason that you became involved in your work from early in your career right up into what you're doing now. Have there been any other main motivating factors that have driven you to keep doing and keep pushing into other areas around domestic and family violence?
I guess it's where I see a need or see a gap. So one of the things in 2017, myself and a few friends started a charity called Standing Shoulder to Shoulder because we saw a bit of a gap in terms of support to women who are experiencing domestic and family violence, particularly women on temporary visas, and also people in the GLBTI community who were experiencing intimate partner violence. So what we wanted to do is set up a really small charity that was staffed by people with lived experience that would provide direct support to those particular groups of women. And so we did.
So you just did
so
it.
We did it. Yeah, and it's still a very small charity. We don't promote ourselves a lot, but word has spread since 2017. And we get calls from lots of different people who donate to us, but we also get calls from a whole variety of agencies that say, you know, can you help with this family?
What's it like being on that end of things where I know you've obviously been involved in organisational stuff before where you've literally had to do the organising. When it's your own charity, what's the capacity like? Are you able to just open the gates and say, come on in, let us help?
No, because we're small, we were at this stage still operating out of two of our own homes, and we're operating, had been up until this year, basically operating on the weekends and in the evenings out of our full-time work. So that's eased up slightly because myself and my partner who do most of the work aren't working as much at the moment. But people have offered, you know, to support us, but we don't want to grow too big. We don't want to become unmanageable. We actually want to stay really small and boutique and, what's the word, bespoke charity. So that...
Sure. I like that. There's some marketing in there somewhere.
There
absolutely.
Is probably. But yeah, you know, I mean, I went this morning to Bunnings and they just donated 3 large baskets full of cleaning products and different stuff like that to us.
That's a success.
That was great. Yeah. I was very happy.
I don't want to gush too much around the awards and achievements that you've been recognised for because I'm sure you don't want to talk about it that much either. But we do have to place some importance here because it is important. Starting with the 2006 WA Citizen of the Year Award for Community Services, what was it like being recognised for that?
I mean, it was a huge shock and surprise, and I didn't actually go to the award because, A, I didn't think I was going to be a recipient, but also I had a meeting in Victoria with one of the peak bodies, so I went to that, and I was a bit confused because they kept ringing me up and saying, "What, are you sure you can't come on?" And I kept saying, "No, I've got a meeting to go to." And so my chair of my board at that time, Pat Giles, she went to my place, so, which was great. I mean, it was a very unexpected recognition, yeah, very unexpected.
That's the kind of acceptance award that you want to hear. Sorry she couldn't be here, not because she's on a yacht, but because Katie's in another meeting for another piece of work. It's remarkable to win something like that. Can you talk to us about why recognition is important? I know maybe if you don't want to talk about it from your own perspective, why is it important that we do recognise people who are devoting so much time and energy to it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's really important to recognise them and to honour the work that people do. Absolutely. Yeah.
Another one of those, of course, and part of the reason that we're here having this conversation is because you were inducted into the WA Women's Hall of Fame. Being inducted in visibility of your work, not just as a woman in WA, but as a woman working in a domestic and family violence space, working for women as well, what's the importance of that to be recognised?
I mean, again, it was a great honour. They inducted, that was the first year of the Women's Hall of Fame, so they inducted 100 women at that time, so it was a huge inducting ceremony. But, that was a great honour, and I've since gone on just recently in the last couple of years to join the Women's Hall of Fame board because that's another group of very dedicated women volunteering their time to make sure that the work of women is recognised and recorded and not lost in the passage of time, which quite often women's work can be.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Even saying things like women's work, I think people have such a distinct idea of what women's work is, and the WA Women's Hall of Fame, obviously, not necessarily rejecting that notion, but just changing it up slightly,
broadening it. Yeah.
When you think about it, and I mean, you're on the board now and you were as part of that first crop of inductees, has it opened your eyes to how many women are doing
amazing
women's work?
Yeah, amazing women's work, absolutely. It's each year I've been honoured to be part of the selection committee for the, so about 14 to 15 women are inducted each year across 7 different areas. And just reading all the applications and nominations that come in and just seeing what women are doing out there, unrecognised to some great extent, unacknowledged, but they just get on and do it. It's just amazing.
Get on and do it, I think, is like the key here, because yeah. I feel like maybe you wouldn't describe yourself like that, but Katie, you just kind of have gotten on and done it for like the last 30 years.
Yeah.
So we need to recognise those people.
Yeah, no, but it's great. I mean, last year, because of COVID, we couldn't have a ceremony, so we inducted a whole lot of women who had from the last 100 years. So reading some of the work of women in the 1860s and 1890s, they're just amazing what they were doing under those really difficult conditions.
Well, sure, we talk about sort of the work that you've been doing and at that turn of sort of discovering feminism, imagining what it would have been like for women back then where, you know, not too much longer before that, you would have been accused of being crazy or in hysteria if you were to raise an opinion on something.
Yes, yeah, and get out there and express an opinion and,
make the change.
Make your change, ask for more, take up more space than you're supposed to as a woman.
Sure, and I guess, like, that's the beautiful thing about the Hall of Fame is just the visibility aspect of the, it's literally a Hall of Fame. And if you didn't know, we had a WA Women's Hall of Fame. Here's over 100 women from the last however long who have now been a part of it.
Yeah.
What's next on the horizon for you? I know you've moved out of the DV space now. Where are you focusing your time and energy to now?
So now I'm working in For Grey, which is the GLBTI Rights in Ageing, which is a very grassroots, small organisation. It's been around 15 years, but it's small. It's got some national funding. And so one of the areas it's got funding for, and so I'm a training coordinator and a trainer in the area of working with aged care providers, residential home care and home care providers, to help them make sure that their organisation is inclusive of GLBTI elders. So GLBTI elders are seen as a special vulnerable cohort under the Aged Care Act, and aged care providers have to, when they're having their assessments, make sure that their policy and practices are inclusive for elders of our community. So that's a whole other area that I hadn't got a good understanding of, aged care, and I'm certainly learning a lot about the aged care and the limitations and the constraints of aged care and funding. Really interested in that at the moment, and that sort of still spills to some degree into my interest in elder abuse and my interest in intimate partner violence and family violence in the GLBTI community.
How did you move into this particular area? I know that we've established that there's lived experience in your first sort of lot of work in the last few decades worth. Where did this particular area of interest come from?
Well, my interest in GLBTI and intimate partner violence and family violence are back in, early 2000s. When I first came back to Perth, I was part of a small group called Outing Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, which was a volunteer group within the gay and lesbian community trying to raise the issue within our community. We couldn't get any traction at all. And then for a short while, the state government funded a group called Same-Sex Domestic Violence Group, which I was the chair of, which was around raising an understanding in the DV sector around same-sex domestic violence. And that lasted for a couple of years, but we still... I mean, that was very innovative, and particularly for the state government to fund it. But we still couldn't get some traction to keep that momentum going. I've also got lived experience in terms of domestic and family violence within a lesbian relationship. So it's been an underlying issue of area of interest for me for quite a while. And then last year I joined the board of Grey, so I was interested in the work that Grey was doing in the aged care sector, and that sort of fits within my interest around elder abuse and, you know, how that changed when, if you're living with someone who's abusing you, they don't stop at 65. It doesn't turn into something else. It still, for a long, often, is domestic and family violence. But also what we find in the GLBTI community is that there's abuse of those elders from paid carers, and there's systemic abuse within the aged care sector towards GLBTI elders.
Mm, we know in the last few years since that Royal Commission was handed down that the aged care sector is rife with abuse rife with issues.
Yeah.
And then adding the complexity in there of queer elder people, particularly those who are living in homes or dealing with other institutions, I imagine there's been a bit of hesitancy or reservation for people to jump both feet in first and really sort this out.
There is, to some extent. I mean, like I said, Grey's been around 15 years doing this work. And what we see when we do the training is that there's people working in the sector who are absolutely passionate about doing the right thing. They really want to know more, and they really want to be open and inclusive. Where some of the problems is that they're the frontline workers, and where the change has to happen in terms of policy and practice and data collection and all of that has to happen at the management level, and that's where not necessarily we get more resistance. But we also have a sector that is, like, you know, obviously under huge pressures in terms of funding, and it's under huge pressures to address its internal levels of abuse that are going on. So there is a lot that needs to be done in that sector. But one of the biggest issues is, like, the issue we have now, we've just done the census. You know, the census is based on this idea that we should all fill it out, because then we'll have data that tells us what our health needs are and what our building needs are and all our needs in the future, except we didn't ask any questions about sexuality.
Well, unless you were male or female,
Or we asked about male, female or non-binary, but in all the relationships we didn't ask, is your relationship a same-sex relationship? Are you a trans person in a relationship? Are you an intersex person? We didn't ask any of that data, which really says we don't actually care about this particular part of our community. We just want to keep being heteronormative and just respond to these needs.
So I see what you're saying there about the frontline not being necessarily the issue. It's the higher up organisational mechanisms that are actually letting down and failing these people.
Yeah, across the whole board, we don't collect data in the health system. We don't collect very good data. If we don't have the data, then we don't have an argument to say you must improve your service provision, because we know there's X amount of people from the GLBTI community coming into your service. Or they're not coming because they know your service isn't inclusive.
So I can see this is your next, I don't know, few decades worth of work ahead of you.
This is my next issue, yes. Yep.
I love that. I love that it's, you know, you're on to the next one. This is fantastic. Where do you see yourself 5 years on from now? Do you have plans to still continue on in this space, or is it kind of just given that you know you'll still be advocating for somebody somewhere?
I would hope so, given, you know, health and other things. But yeah, I would like to be able to still feel that I'm making a difference and making a change and providing some assistance to improve things.
You've been immortalised in the Hall of Fame. We can see you in there now, and generations of women later to come will also see the impact that you've had. For people who maybe read through the Hall of Fame or come and find your work elsewhere, what is it that you want the takeaway to be? What do you want to be remembered for?
She worked hard and she made a difference.
Thanks to Keddie Crystal and all the women at the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. And thank you very much to the team who make Herstory happen every week. Our executive producer, Danae Gibson, our assistant producers, who we affectionately refer to as our hall monitors. They're Sophie Minasale, Fiona Bartholomaeus, and Courtney Withers. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses, and artwork from Peter Roebuck. Zoe Zarzicki also helped to edit this episode. Herstory is made possible with funding from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. Keddie refers to a couple of organisations by their acronym in this episode. GRAY is the GLBT Rights in Ageing Group. It's a voluntary group that works to enhance the quality of life for gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans, intersex elders, focusing on improving GLBTI awareness in aged care services, both in residential and community care. And SARC is the Sexual Assault Resource Centre that is located in Perth and provides a range of free services to people in the metropolitan area affected by sexual violence. If you or somebody you know needs to speak with SARC, they always provide free telephone advice and support to those by giving them a call on 1800 199 888. You can also call 1800 RESPECT. That's the National Sexual Assault Domestic Family Violence Counselling Service. They can be reached at 1800 737 732. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll catch you next week for episode 5.